Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, Episode 26, Alone Again, Naturally. Remember that this is a listener-supported podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then please consider supporting it. One way to do that is to sign up for membership, giving you access to our exclusive premium episodes. You can do that by going to the website, thehistoryofpodcast.com, and clicking on the PayPal subscription button. Special thanks to our newest pioneers, listeners Jessica and Amanda. Thank you, I couldn't do this show without you. On March 23rd, 1623, it was time for a town meeting and the annual elections. Bradford explained the situation to the citizens of Plymouth. They, and the neighbouring colony of Wessagusset, were in grave danger. There was a vast conspiracy of the Native American tribes in the region to destroy them. And Bradford made the case that if they wanted to survive, then they would need to make the first move. The Pilgrims were not comfortable at all with this suggestion. The Indians had been hospitable to them, and they didn't want to attack unless they were assaulted first. But they valued Massasoit's advice. He warned them that the first news they would hear of aggression would be the destruction of Wessagusset, so they would need to move before that happened. The plan of action was endorsed, and Bradford had his authority to make war. This, at least, is how the Pilgrims tell the story. I mentioned last week that I'm skeptical. The Pilgrims insist on their jovial relationship with the Indians, and that the attack was entirely down to the behaviour of Wessagusset. But this really doesn't make sense. There have been skirmishes and fights between the Pilgrims and the Indians from as soon as they landed. The threat of attack has always been there, so I'm not satisfied with the explanation that this was a sudden break in relations. Something must have been going on. Likewise, if it was just Wessagusset that was the problem, and the Massachusetts really didn't want to attack or provoke Plymouth, you get the feeling they could have just let the Wessagusset colonists starve to death. At this point, they had mostly abandoned their own settlement, and were half-starved, half-naked, hiding in the woods. It doesn't seem like a threat to require a grand conspiracy. It all doesn't quite add up. Anyway, Standish, the Pilgrims' go-to military guy, was selected to handle the matter. First things first, Wessagusset needed to be warned, but how to do so? Standish would travel to Wessagusset under the guise of a trading mission, warn the colonists, and then punish the conspirators. He didn't want to give the Indians any reason to suspect he knew what was going on. So, in addition to this being a trade mission, he only travelled with 8 men. It was a gamble, but a necessary one. Standish set sail on March 25th. When he arrived at Wessagusset, he found a happy Sanders who told him how friendly the Indians were being. He told them how he allowed Indians to stay with him. He trusted them so completely that he did not keep his weapons with him. Most of the population were quite dispersed. Standish ordered him to recall his men, and they were ordered to stay at Wessagusset on pain of death. They were given some of the precious Plymouth corn seed supply to keep them there. In the next day or so, an Indian appeared at Wessagusset, supposedly to trade, but he was in reality a spy. Based on Standish's demeanour, he suspected that the plot had been found out. This provoked resistance, and those Indians present threatened Standish, wielding knives. Standish wasn't provoked, wanting to get all the conspirators together before doing anything. He soon realised that this was impractical, and he gathered those present in a room with his own men. A fight broke out, and Standish killed most of them. That same day, there is a report from one of the English who was living with the Indians. They received a messenger, and all grew sad, and then left. This unnerved one of the English, who hastily returned to Wessagusset, probably saving his life. The next day, Standish's 4th in Wessagusset, a skirmish broke out with a nearby tribe, although the Native Americans hastily withdrew and there were no deaths. Following this, a youth who had been friendly with the English came over and divulged some details about the plot. The Wessagusset colonists had been constructing 3 boats for the Indians, and the plan had been to commence the massacre as soon as they were finished. What this meant was that had Standish arrived 3 days later, he would have been too late. Standish encouraged the Wessagusset colonists to return to life as normal now that the Indians had been scared off and the colony saved. They would no longer have to fear for their lives. But it was not to be. The experience had not been a pleasant one, and they just wanted to get the hell out of there. They took most of Standish's precious corn seed and set off for the fishing vessels off the coast of Maine. They were going home. Wessagusset was abandoned. Plymouth was alone again, naturally. However, not everybody left there. A few weren't done with the New World quite yet, and they would join the pilgrims at Plymouth. Standish returned home with his men, and the few from Wessagusset who stayed. There was a celebration at their return, at the fact they hadn't lost a soul. The head of one of the conspirators, one Witiwamat, was placed on a pike above Forth Hill, an old European tradition. King Philip will get the same treatment when we make it to King Philip's War, but that is quite a ways away. While Standish was at Wessagusset, a Neposet spy had made their way into Plymouth, but they were seized and placed in Fort Hill. He was broken when he saw Witiwamat's head, and they confessed the whole plot. This scared many of the Neposets into staying away from the English. They withdrew into swamps, but they struggled to find food there, and many died. Those tribes of the Cape were cowed. They were now subdued. They would side with the English during King Philip's War. Massasoit himself acted very conciliatory with those involved with the plot. Soon after this, the colony received a surprise visitor, Weston. He had been sailing over to visit Wessagusset, but had been shipwrecked off the Maine coast, and only made his way to Plymouth with the help of some Indians. The pilgrims helped him out despite their own poverty. They loaned him some beaver skins, which allowed him to fit out one of their ships and start a trade. He never repaid the loan, and threatened to expose the leaders at Plymouth for going beyond their authority in lending him the furs in the first place. Weston doesn't come across very well in this tale. While Weston was certainly a bit of a... No, wait, I can't say that word. This is a family-friendly show, we have kids listening. Grinch. Let's go with that. So, while Weston was certainly a bit of a Grinch, the other backers of the colony were a bit more supportive. One of the London merchants, one John Pierce, finangled a way of securing the patent for himself, and planned to set himself up as the sole proprietor of the company. He decided to set sail to the New World with the Paragon in December 1622, but was forced back by storms. He regrouped and set off once more in February 1623, but he never made it. The Paragon was caught up in a tempest in the mid-Atlantic, and the ship was horribly damaged. But it managed to make its way back to England somehow. The voyage had cost the London merchants something in the region of over £600, but because of Pierce's legal situation with the patent to the company, he bore the brunt of the loss and was ruined. To cover his losses, he was forced to sell his shares and his patent to the company, but the rest of the debt wasn't received. The pilgrims, now on their own, were in serious trouble over food shortages. They realised that they needed to make this crop a good one if they were going to survive her. Something radical would need to change. And, indeed, it did. The nature of Plymouth was fundamentally altered, and it is really hard to not see this as a sign of the America that would emerge from these early roots. Plymouth had operated on a completely communal system, but it wasn't working. Whatever anyone grew would end up in the common store, and those who produced little corn, and those who produced a lot of corn, would receive the same. There was a general discontent with this system. It was noticed that some were not showing the desired effort, since they would get the same amount of food as people who did. So, how to change it? The common field was abolished. The land would instead be divided by household, each receiving 1 acre per person. Most of what was grown would be kept by individual families, but a common store would also exist, with a proportion of the food each household would grow going into it. It was a game changer. People were more invested in their own farms than they had been in the communal field, and it wasn't improper for women and children to work on a family farm in the way it was to the pilgrims, for them to work in the communal field. A far greater area was cultivated, and things were looking very promising. But there is always a but. In this case, the but is drought. It began in early summer and lasted weeks. Because of the fish fertiliser, the soil was in better condition than it might have been, but still, the younger plants became dry and the older plants wilted. If the corn crop failed, it would be a disaster. All would be lost. In July, they held a day of prayer during which the pilgrims prayed, sang, chanted, and went through scripture for 9 hours or so. When they made their way home, a fine rain began, which continued for 14 days. Winslow writes, quote, "It was hard to see whether our withered corn or drooping affections were most quickened or revived. Such was the bounty and goodness of our God." End quote. A Thanksgiving service was held for this, and the event made a great impression upon Hobomok and the other Indians. The famine lasted 3 or 4 months, during which the pilgrims had no idea where their next meal would come from. Some of their hunters were stationed permanently in the woods, looking for food. Miraculously, despite the growing weakness of the population, they once again remained healthy. As we move into the summer of 1623, several ships arrived in Plymouth. It's funny how quickly the European world follows its pioneers. A few short years ago, Plymouth was the very edge of the quote-unquote civilised world. Now, there was fairly regular travel crisscrossing the Atlantic. In July, a ship called the Plantation arrived, bringing with it an old friend, one Francis West. You should remember him for the prominent position he had held in the Virginia colony. He was the younger brother of Thomas West, the Baron Delaware. He was appointed admiral for the New England coast, placed in charge of securing the monopoly of the fishing in the region for the Council of New England. How this worked was the council held the rights to fish in the region, and then fishermen would have to pay a rather expensive license fee in order to fish there. The operation met with mixed success. West was unable to do anything about the fishermen from the west of England. They were stubborn and wouldn't be moved. As for everything else, the size of the fishing fleet shrank from 400 ships down to 150. The matter was taken to Parliament. A debate took place between the fishermen complaining and Gorges, the owner of the Council for New England, defending his monopoly. Parliament sided with the fishermen and passed a bill to make fishing free in the region, but the king wouldn't assent to the decision, and it did not become law. Another ship arrived, carrying food, but once it realised how desperate Plymouth was, it dramatically raised the amount for some peas. The pilgrims refused to pay, and the ship sailed for Virginia instead. Before we move into autumn, there is one more thing to cover. Yet more ships. The 140-ton Anne and the 44-ton Little James. These two ships brought with them 100 new settlers to the colony, greatly increasing its size. Many were from Leyden, and they were friends and relatives of the earlier settlers, and they included the ones that Pierce had failed to bring over in the Paragon. We know that 97 of them stayed, for a few were so completely ill-suited to the colony that Bradford paid to return them back to England on the next ship. We have Bradford's own description of the reunion. Quote, "These passengers, when they saw their low and poor conditions ashore, were much dainted and dismayed, and, according to their diverse humours, were diversely affected. Some wished themselves in England again, others fell a-weeping, fancying their own misery in what they saw now in others. Other, some pitying the distress they saw their friends had long been in, and still were under. In a word, all were full of sadness. Only some of their old friends rejoiced to see them, and that it was no worse with them, for they could not expect it should be better, and now hoped they should enjoy better days together. And truly, it was no marvel that they should be thus affected, for they were in a very low condition. Many were ragged in apparel, and some little better than half naked, though some that were stored before were well enough in this regard. But for food they were all alike, save some that had got a few peas off the ship that was last here. The best dish they could present their friends with was a lobster or a piece of fish, without bread or anything else but a cup of fair spring water." End quote. I should clarify that while lobster is now considered a luxury food, this only developed towards the end of the 19th century. They were extremely common along the New England coast, and were considered trash food, fit only for the lowest of the low. This is the point Bradford is trying to make. It's not a humble brag. That's where we'll end things for this week, before getting into the autumn of 1623 next time out. If you've enjoyed today's episode, then please consider signing up for membership. You can do that by going to the website, thehistoryofpodcast.com, and clicking on the PayPal subscription button. You can continue the conversation on social media by liking the show's Facebook page, facebook.com/thehistoryofpodcast, following me on Twitter, @historyjamie, and by sending me an email, thehistoryofpodcast@gmail.com. I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.